Mr. Bergstrom, would you like to follow up at this point, talking about another option, the Roth IRA option?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the State Retirement System. In your file, you should have a handout that says save. And as legislators, you are eligible for our deferred compensation plan, and we'll be eligible for our Roth plan. So if you have not yet enrolled, we'd be happy to sign you up after the meeting. So, so you do have a handout of some pages, and so I'd like to go through that. We also gave you a copy of the new brochure about the Roth 457 plan that we will be adding January 1st. MSRS provides a one-stop service to our participants if we want to go through the handout. I see you looking at the brochure, but that's going to mess me up. So, we have six defined benefit plans. We administer a defined contribution health care savings plan, and we also offer a deferred compensation plan, which is a defined contribution plan that is voluntary that members enroll in. We do provide, if we move to the next slide, internal customer service. We handle all of the customer service at MSRS. We contract with a record keeper to handle trades and contributions that come in. All of the staff that deal with this plan are licensed. They have a Series 6 and 63 license, and they do provide financial education. We cannot provide investment advice because we are not licensed to do so. We have offices in St. Paul, not far from here. Then we have offices in Duluth, Detroit Lakes, Mankato, and St. Cloud. Then we have field staff that go to cities and counties and explain the program. So the highlights of deferred comp, the plan that we've been administering since 1971, has it's created under IRS code 457B. It is available not just to state employees. It is available to city, county, school employees as well. So it's available to virtually every public employee in the state. We have 601 employers participating in the program, and we have just shy of 80,000 active or 80,000 participants. From a size standpoint, we're the fifth largest governmental plan. We're pretty proud of this. When you look at the county of Los Angeles, the city of New York, the state of New York, we're in the top five. And we have very good participation. 65% of state employees participate. This is a voluntary program. So in essence, a lot of state employees have a hybrid plan. You've been talking about a hybrid plan. We have a defined benefit plan, and then they have a voluntary defined contribution plan on top of that. And you can see the state of Minnesota is by far our largest employer. The Minneapolis School District is second, and so on down the line. So you can see it's very... it's available in all parts of the state. The plan features that we have, it's done through salary deferral. The state board chooses the investment options. We allow portability, transfers in, rollouts in and out of the program. So we do have people that take money from a private sector plan or a 401k and they roll it in. And then likewise, we have people who roll money out as well after they terminate service. We have payout options, lump sum payments, we have monthly payments, and we do offer annuity products as well. The key features of the plan is, it's solely funded through participant contributions. So the participants pay for the plan. Our administrative fees that we charge is 7 basis points or 7/100ths of 1%. That would be $7 for every $10,000 in their account. And we charge that on the first $100,000, bringing our annual maximum fee to $70. We have both active investments and passive investments. And you can see that the active investments, the actively managed investment annual cost is 0.64%. We have a lot of Vanguard index funds at 0.08%, so 0.08%. So we offer low cost investment options. We have 11 core investment options. We also offer some optional features to our employees. We have a self-directed brokerage account, so if people don't like our 11 options, they can pay $30 and have access to literally about 2,000 different mutual funds. We do have annuities that they can purchase when they leave. We have advisory services. You can get free investment advice online through the website, or if you want someone to handle your account for you, you can pay a fee to have people do that for you. We just recently added target date funds. That is where you pick your target date. So if I were planning and retiring in 2020, I would pick the 2020 fund, and as I get closer to that, the fund slowly gets more conservative. So it kind of takes the thought out of investing it and does that for you. So we just added those recently. Starting January 1st of this year, we will be offering a Roth 457 plan. That was authorized under the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010 on the federal level. We had passed a state law in anticipation of this federal law several years earlier to allow us to offer the Roth 457. The MSRS board did approve offering that to all public employers effective this coming January 1st. As of today, 43 employers have elected to offer the program. Not all employers will offer it because they need to make some changes to their payroll system, so we expect that number to grow over time. So our deferred comp plan over on the left side is a pre-tax deferral. The current program we have, the contributions are not taxed going in. They're tax deferred going in. The investments grow tax deferred, but people pay taxes when they take it out. So it's all taxable income when they withdraw their funds. With the Roth, it's the opposite of that. It's taxed when it's put in. The investments grow tax-free, and there are no taxes paid when you take it out. So it's kind of a different philosophy. Some people will be better off under the current program, the tax deferral program, and some will be better under a Roth, and we will try to help people through that decision, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So we're very excited about this. Somebody who's young in a very low tax bracket. You know, when you're young, you've got a house and you've got kids that you can write off. Be a great way for people to save into the future. To qualify for a distribution for a Roth, you do have to leave it in for 5 years. So 5 years from the date your first contribution goes in. 5 years after that, you can take it out. And once you reach age 59 and a half. So there are some requirements as when you can draw that money. It has very high limits, which is a very attractive thing for a lot of people as well, that you won't see in a Roth IRA. The 2012 limits would be $17,000 under age 50, $22,500 for people over age 50, and $34,000 for those people who use the catch-up. That has to be 3 years prior to normal retirement to use the catch-up. So it will allow people to defer a lot of income if they so choose. So who might benefit from a Roth? Those who are in lower tax brackets today and believe they will be in a higher tax bracket in the future. Those who are already high income earners and likely will have a high tax bracket before and after retirement. Younger participants that I already talked about, where they can have a many years of that tax-free growth and will not have to pay taxes on the way out. And those who want some flexibility, you would be able to participate in both the regular tax deferred and the Roth at the same time. And sometimes it's nice to have money that will not be taxed when you take it out as well. So it really gives some flexibility to participants. It's just another tool that they will have available to them. We have, from a tool standpoint, we are working on them. In the brochure we handed out, there's a decision tree to help people decide which one is better for them. You can't read it on here because it's small and it is in your book, but it's a way for them to decide. We also are going to have online calculators to allow participants to go online and help decide which would be better for them, a tax deferred contribution or an already taxed Roth contribution. And then if we compare the features of the Roth of a Roth IRA to a Roth 457. The 457 actually has a lot of features that the Roth IRA will not have. The primary one is the contribution limit is much higher under the 457 plan. One of the advantages of a Roth IRA is there's no required minimum distribution, where with the Roth 457, it will have to be taken out at 70.5. There's no income limits for a Roth 457 where there is for a Roth IRA. They have certain times they cannot contribute, and a Roth 457 will not have a 10% penalty for early distribution. And the chart kind of emphasizes those differences as well on the bottom. We will also be offering in-plan conversion, so if someone wants to convert a lump sum from their regular deferred comp to Roth, they would be able to do so, and they would then be paying taxes in that taxable year. So, Mr. Chair, that's just a quick overview of the program that we plan to offer. We're excited about it. We think it'll be a great tool. Where it's not for everybody, we think for some people it will offer a different alternative investment.
Mr. Bergstrom, who's got the assignment of briefing or orienting new legislators as they come on board as to what their options are?
Mr. Chair, we have field staff that come to both the House and the Senate and schedule those hearings. The House has decided to offer the Roth 457, and the Senate has not yet made a decision. But we do have staff that come here on a regular basis, and they post flyers throughout the building. So we'd be happy to do that. Kelly Knight in the House side usually sets those up.
Well, when I first came in, I don't recall any orientation about any of that. I know the Roth wasn't an option then, but it would have been nice to have known about some of that. And when I came in, anyway, there was no mention of that whatsoever. So I think it's important for people coming on board to be given the briefing as to what their options might be. Any other questions, Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, it's always the case of we don't get very good orientations, but certainly in when the House and Senate do their orientation programs for new members, they should include retirement issues as well. And I assume that they did. It's been so long since I was a new member, I can't remember.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've been appreciative of the fact that this brochure, no matter where you're at in this thing, I thought this was really helpful. I can't wait to give it to my kids and others as well, because I think for anybody whatsoever, matter of fact, even your constituent services, this is a very educational pages in here, the decision tree, and some of those things on the comparison are some of the best that I found. So I want to thank you to you and your staff for really doing a good job, because part of the educational process for everybody is having a good tool to use on something like this. So it's really good. I thought it was interesting, Mr. Chairman, that Minnesota, under the five largest governmental 457 plans, Minnesota is number five, the fifth largest. I think that shows that our employees themselves, because this is above and beyond their pension, are very interested in this, very interested in taking that responsibility and doing that. And that's really good for them. The Roth, of course, is just another option. And I thought the educational information, but I think having a tool like this, whether you do Roth or not or whatever you do, this is a really good tool. So I want to say thank you to you and your staff for doing that. But I think it also shows our Minnesota employees like these kinds of arrangements. Thank
Chair,
you.
President. Kiffmeyer, thank you for the comments. I will certainly pass them on to the staff that work on the brochure. I wish I
knew
I
you would. Thank
it.
You.
Any other questions, Mr. Bergstrom? If not, while you're here, maybe we could call Ms. Vanek down at the same time. I understand the two of you are prepared to talk about the special experience studies that you're about to embark upon.
Members, if I could, at this point, on item 8 in your packets, there are two letters that are attached to a memo on tab 8, and these are the items that Mr. Bergstrom and Ms. Vanek are going to be talking about.
I don't know. I got it.
Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Bennett?
Yep, Mr. Chair, we have done an experience study for our general employees' retirement plan. So we are up to date on that one. We have asked our actuary to do an experience study on our state patrol plan, our correctional plan, and our judges plan. And according to your actuarial standards, we need your permission to do so. I'm not sure I understand that requirement, but it is a requirement. So we are doing it anyway. We've started the process, but we are asking for your permission to authorize that. Our plan for the experience study would be to have it done in January. Our board would then act at it in its January meeting, and by the end of January, we will have submitted to the Pension Commission any recommendations for assumption changes that come out of that experience study. Essentially, what the experience study does is it looks at what the actuary assumes and what reality is, and if they need adjusting, we make that adjustment. So we do plan on having that to you early or late in January, so you can deal with any recommendations that the actuary and the MSRS board would make.
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. We have also, in compliance with the standards, submitted a letter notifying you that we have talked to our actuary about doing a study on the correctional plan. The correctional plan was just implemented by the legislature, directed to for us to implement in 1999, and no experience analysis has been done because we didn't have sufficient history to really analyze. With mortality improvements and the discussion on the assumed rate of return, we thought it was time that we engaged in an experience study. I do have not set out timelines with our actuary at this point in time, but I certainly can have that discussion. I would expect that since we use the same actuary and Mr. Bergstrom's request got in ahead of mine, I might not be able to commit until maybe late February, early March for a return, but I will certainly let you know what we are able to work out. 2%.
So, Mr. Martin, we need a motion here to authorize.
Yes.
And what should that motion say, essentially?
Essentially, members, I would suggest that you approve the requests from the MSRS and the ERA administrators for their preparation of experience studies.
Okay.
So moved.
Moved by Senator Pappas. Senator Dimmel.
Thanks. I just have a question, Mr. Chair. I mean, we don't need to discuss it prior to the motion. I have just a question. Keying off Mr. Bergstrom's kind of question that he posed out there, why do they need permission specifically from this commission in order to do the experience study? I mean, I assume it's a function of law, but why is the rationale for that requirement?
Ms. Byrne?
Member Senator Dibble, it's really not a question of law as much as it is a question of a document known as the Standards for Actuarial Work. It is a document, or it's a set of regulations that the Pension Commission prescribes, has done so. It was directed by law to do so in 1984 and has updated them periodically, most recently a year and a half ago. And it tells the actuaries, it prescribes the rules that the actuaries use in putting together actuarial evaluations, experience studies, various documents, cost-benefit analysis for proposed pension legislation.
Mm-hmm.
This requirement has been part of the standards since 1984. I was on staff, not here, but in Pennsylvania in 1984, mm-hmm. So I have no concurrent or no clear understanding of exactly why our requirement is there, other than to surmise that it probably was to standardize these experience studies so that we got all of a particular type of employee at essentially the same time, and by having the plans come to the commission with their request, we could then suggest to the plan that wasn't doing, for instance, if these are largely public safety plan,
mm-hmm.
If one of the public safety plans was not going to have an experience study done, that might not make sense, and we could then encourage to have a comprehensive set of public safety plans. It also probably prohibits or is a way to regulate some cherry-picking that might occur, that a plan might, because it has some experience that it thinks is different and perhaps beneficial to its perspective, to come in looking for an experience study to get the benefit of having a better or a different actuarial assumption, and leaving other things unaddressed. That would be my guess, but I have no contemporaneous notion about what the commission was thinking in 84. It was not an issue a year and a half ago when we had our current consulting actuary review the standards, mm-hmm. and recommend updates and changes in the standards. The interested parties did not raise this issue at that time.
Senator Whipple?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is it a similar practice in other states to have this kind of check, if you will?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, it's always hard with 50 states to know what other states are doing. Uh-huh. In general, other states appear to, in my experience, to have less clear regulation of what the actuarial work that's done for their public pension plans might be. And I don't recall ever seeing anything related to experience studies except in Minnesota. But that is also Mr. Brainerd tomorrow, who does work with the state pension plan administrators in 50 states, may have a better sense of this, since he has a more comprehensive view in general.
I'll try to remember to ask him. And one final question,
sure.
Mr. Chair. Thanks. I was reading the scanning and trying to absorb the note on but maybe requiring more of perhaps the smaller groups to do quadrennial. And there was some discussion about cost benefit. Are these expensive studies? Is that a consideration?
Mr. Ward?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I would defer to the two fund administrators. As Mr. Bergstrom indicated, he's already in the process of having the two experience studies performed. I presume he already has a budget. Mm-hmm. Ms. Vanek has already had the PERA police and fire plan experience study done and would have some sense of that cost and may well have a budget for mm-hmm. for the correctional plan.
Ms. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, if I may remember right, the experience study for each plan is about $25,000 for the public safety, a little bit more for our bigger plan.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's the dollar figure I recall, but I certainly can look it up and let you know what we paid for our police and fire. And that's one of the, I know you're in the middle of a vote, but I also wanted to mention you did just approve assumption changes that resulted from our police and fire experience study that was conducted about a year and a half ago. So that one's been taken care of. And I just wanted to follow up with that, that plan doesn't need to be done right now because it's just been completed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fully informed and ready to vote.
All right. Any further question or discussion? Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, it's totally up to you. It's really not my business, but my compatriots from Duluth and St. Paul are having them done. You could approve all of them at the same time, so they're totally legal, unlike some of us up here.
Senator Pappas, do you want to amend your motion to include Duluth and St. Paul as well?
Sure.
Further discussion to the motion? Everybody understand the motion? Authorizing those funds to proceed with their experience studies and the planning for that. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you.
Yes, we're going to have Mr. Bicker speak to an issue that was recently in the news, and apparently he had to leave. We will ask him to talk about that tomorrow. I did talk to him, and he's prepared to do that. I had thought that he would want to hear the interest rate assumption discussion and hybrid, since that certainly relates to his work. We will move forward now with the item 7, and I want to mention that here after Mr. Martin goes through his next items, If there is anybody in the audience who wishes to be heard on anything we've discussed today or anything else, we will take an opportunity for people to come and testify. There are others who have specifically requested to do so tomorrow, and we'll start the day tomorrow with testimony from those who have requested it. So just wanted to give everybody that advance heads up. Mr. Martin, proceed with item number 7.
Members, at the October meeting of the commission, there was a request or a question about what mortality tables are currently in force. And while we had tried to put together a compendium of the various actuarial assumptions in force, there was a little bit of a hiccup on the mortality tables. And so what you have here is in one place the for the various plans grouped by type of employee, the mortality tables that are currently in effect. What the mortality table does is it provides the actuary with a notion of, or provides a length of time over which a pension benefit is potentially payable. They're broken down by age, and they provide, in effect, the longevity for individuals at a given age. Thereby, the actuary uses mortality tables to project the length that a benefit is going to be paid. Retirement age assumptions, which is a different assumption, gives the actuary a sense of when the benefit starts. Other assumptions set the a way to estimate the amount of the benefit. Hence, the accrued liability of the pension plan can ultimately be calculated. For the first set of numbers in this fairly number-filled document relate to the general employee plans. And set across the page are MSRS General, PERA General, TRA, and the MRF division of PERA. Because there were experience studies recently for these plans, these mortality tables have been updated recently, and we use something called the RP2000 table as the basic table. Something that goes on in mortality tables, and if you look at MSRS General for the healthy pre-retirement mortality, so this would be the upper left-hand box of numbers, there are things called set forwards and setbacks. This is how an actuary adjusts a table for a population based on the past experience of that population. Where they don't quite match the national table, but if you assumed a member was either younger or older than that given age, if there's a better match, that's what that set forward or set back refers to. So for MSRS General, the set forward means that males are considered to be 3 years older than their actual age for purposes of the table. And the setback is females are expected to be, we're using the mortality expectation for a female who's 1 year younger. And that proves to be a better match than the national table.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
So, Mr. Martin, it doesn't mean that men are living longer and women are not than was projected. That's not doesn't mean that.
No.
Okay. Can you explain what it means again? I didn't quite.
Senator Pappas, based on a body of past experience, there are tables that work out that provide an estimate of how long a given male or a given female are going to live. Mm-hmm. They do differ based on. They tend to differ based on gender. And because the population is nationwide, for a given pension fund where there is sufficient past data, and there isn't a good match, the first thing that the actuary does is looks to, is there a better match if we assume people are older or younger than they currently are? And does that give a better general trend line? And in the case of MSRS General, we're assuming that males are 3 years older. We set the table forward 3 years, and we assume that females are 1 year younger than the national table, and that produces a better match.
A better match between what and what?
Actual experience and what the table is projecting.
And the net result is kind of what is the... What is this? What does this prove to us? I'm somehow not getting the point.
Senator Daley, have the answer to that?
Mr. Chairman, the question that I had, I think, may tie into hers. And okay. Rather than talk about generalities,
how long people are gonna live?
If you could specifically address, if you look at age 75, 3 years forward for males, setback 1 year for females in the MSRS general column, 4.2%. Then you go to para general, 75 years old, it's 5.3%. I would have expected, because you're moving in that direction, that TRA 5 and 7 then would have been maybe 6.4% if you extrapolate what has happened in the first two columns, but it's 0.845%. And I don't... Can you explain for age 75 the 4.2, the 5.3, and the 0.84%? Maybe that will help us understand...
These are the...
with this specific example, what is happening?
Yes.
Mr. Byrne?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, these are percentages of the population that are age 75 are expected to die in any given year.
Oh.
So 4.2% of all the 75-year-olds, this is healthy pre-retirement. So this is an active employee who's 75. We're talking about presumably a very small population.
In MSRS?
In MSRS. That 4.2% of them are expected to die in any given year. I think you're seeing a pattern that might make more sense to you if you look at the healthy post-retirement and compare. Those are probably, because they're not active employees, these are retirees, you're probably, that's a bigger group at those advanced ages, and you're probably seeing a pattern that makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't the variations in that healthy post-retirement that there are in the employee. That's rather interesting that... there are more variations there among active employees. Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In hearing that explanation, am I to think then that this RP 2000 non-annuitant generational table, et cetera, that isn't what's below here in this column by age? That is some other table that you're going from or using in this computation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, the underlying table is the RP 2000, and this is showing you what the rates will be after the adjustments are made.
So it's not this table.
Well, it's this table.
That's the table you use to get this computation of how many people would die.
It's the base for the derivation of this table.
I suppose you could interpret these variations here as if you want to live, don't retire. Don't continue working here.
I think we should keep working.
I think that's better advice.
Members, looking at these tables, what you're looking at on page one are the most recently adapted tables or approved tables. These are the ones that were... reviewed in the most recent set of experience studies. These represent a change from the prior table prior to the most recent change which was done in 2010. After the Pension Commission reviewed the experience studies for MSRS, PERA, and TRA, these represented a shift from the group annuity mortality table, 1983 group annuity mortality table, to a new table, and they were adjusted based on the most recent experience of the plans. So these are the most up-to-date that we have, whatever they show. If you turn to page 2, these are the four public safety plans. They have not been adjusted for a while. They're the group annuity tables. It's an older table, and there are differences here. And this is one of the discussion points from last time, is how often should we do experience studies, and what do we get from experience studies? And experience studies provide you a basis for determining whether you should make an assumption change and what that change ought to be. And there will be experience studies for all of the four plans on page 2. PERA, police and fire, which is the third table over from the left, PERA-PNF, has already been done. You just approved Mr. Bergstrom doing the experience studies for MSRS Correctional and State Patrol, and you just approved the PERA Correctional experience study. So we will now see how close the existing assumption, this assumption, is to recent experience. On the bottom of page 2, we have the legislators, constitutional officers, and judges. There are no active constitutional officers in the constitutional officers plan. There are only 41 or 42 existing legislators who are covered by the legislators plan. It was closed to new members in 1997, and you just approved an experience study for the judges' retirement plan, for which there hasn't been an experience study since the mid-'80s. And then on page 3 is the Duluth teachers and St. Paul teachers. Duluth teachers uses an adaptation of the 83 group annuity mortality table, the 1994 group annuity mortality table, and St. Paul teachers still uses the 1983 group annuity mortality table. While it may not be satisfying, I do try and give you some sense of what these tables are and what they do on page 4. Historically, at least through 2003, the group annuity, the 1983 group annuity mortality table, which is here, it's the GAM-83 mortality table, was the most commonly used mortality table, both public and private sector. But it dates back to the experience that was collected in the mid-60s. So it's a relatively old table. Now, if it gives us the right pattern, it probably doesn't matter when it was put together, if it reflects recent experience, because you can adapt a table based on setbacks and set forwards. So a table that gives you generally the right thrust can still be used, can still be helpful. So it's the simple fact that it's old doesn't necessarily mean it's not correct. The actuaries can tell you how difficult it is to determine what kind of adjustments are needed, and just how much work has to be done in adapting an older table to more current actuarial experience. The 94 group annuity mortality table, this is number 2 on the list of tables on the bottom of page 4 was based on some 1986 numbers, actually mid-1980 numbers, and it's an update of the 83 group annuity table. This is the sole plan in our systems that uses the 94 group annuity table would be the Duluth Teachers Plan. And then the RP 2000 table was the table that was recently utilized for the three major general statewide plans. This is data from early 1990s. So that's the derivation of these tables. A table that I got from one of the accessible reviews of these tables tries to provide some sense of what the difference is between the group annuity 83 table and the RP 2000 table. It produces somewhat longer, somewhat lengthened longevity for males, 2 to 11% depending upon age, and 3 to 5% shorter longevity for females than the 83 table. So the point of this memo was because there wasn't a good sense of useful comparison of the mortality tables that were utilized by our plans in the prior memo from September. This is trying to specifically address mortality tables, give you their derivation, give you some sense of them.
So is the appropriate conclusion here that we are updating where needed at this point, because that was an issue we raised before, where some of these mortality tables too old to be reliable. And except for legislators and constitutional officers, I think we have set in motion and updating where we need to.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, what I would conclude is not necessarily that the tables are necessarily out of date that we're using, but they've not been adapted fairly regularly and not very recently. And what we're doing is we have a process now with what you did today is that we're going to have essentially all of the major plans, all the plans with any significant population in them, subjected to an experience study. That experience study will include a review of their expected mortality versus actual mortality, will give us a sense of where the current mortality tables are insufficient or incorrect, and will allow us then to construct better tables than we currently have. They may well include a shift to the RP 2000 table for those plans that are not currently using that table, but a lot will depend upon the particular actuary. This is where there's both science and art involved in the process. And some actuaries may prefer one of the other tables that are available and may or may not want to go to the RP 2000 table.
Any other questions or comments? Very thorough, as usual, analysis of where things are at. If there are no further questions or comments, let's move to the next item. We've taken care of 8, so number 9.
Members, number 9 has to do with a question that Senator Daley had about the exposure drafts for the Government Accounting Standards Board Statement 25 and 27 review. If you remember, the generally accepted accounting principles for the public sector are set by the Government Accounting Standards Board, known as GASB. GASB is currently in the process of circulating exposure drafts for changes in two of their statements, one related to what has to be reported by public pension plans for their annual financial reports, and the other, what has to be reported by employing units, public sector employing units, with respect to their public employee pension plan coverage that they're utilizing. The specific question that we were asked to look at was the definition of the actuarial value of assets, and did it comply with the change in GASB? And the change that was identified by Ms. Ferkel, the Deputy Legislative Auditor, when she reviewed the exposure drafts for us, was that the actuarial value of assets was permissible if it was no more than a five-year-long adjustment in market value as per in the process of constructing the actuarial value of assets. Minnesota law does utilize something called the actuarial value of assets. It was added to state law in 2000. And the purpose is to try and smooth the market value of assets that we recognize for when we compare assets to liabilities in determining our funding ratios for our public pension plans. The idea is to smooth out short-term volatility in the market values and to get what then would be a better gauge on whether our assets are keeping pace with our accrued liabilities. We use a five-year smoothing mechanism. It's not just a five-year average. It's a little more complex than that. And I've given you on the bottom of page one out of the 2000 valuation for MSRS General, how it's computed. What we're basically doing is looking at the difference between what the expected return would be at the actuarial interest rate assumption, which is 8.5% generally, and what we actually received, the actual investment performance, and taking, we're doing that over a five-year period, and we're taking various portions, we're recognizing various portions of that difference. We're recognizing, in this case, it's indicated here as the percentage not recognized. We only recognize 20% of the difference between what we did actually earn and what we should have earned if we'd earned the full actuarial interest rate assumption for the most recent year. And we increasingly recognize larger and larger percentages of the difference until you get back five years when you've recognized all of it. This does produce a actuarial value of assets that's somewhat different than the market value, as you would expect. What it generally does is it delays the recognition of either gains or losses. On page three, there's a graph for you of the difference between the market value of assets and the actuarial value of assets over time for MSRS General. And the market value of assets is the series of boxes. The actuarial value of assets is the series of triangles. And you can see that in some sense, the actuarial value of assets is a somewhat smoother line than if we had just utilized the market value of assets. So if smoothing is the goal, this does provide greater smoothing than just market value alone. On page 3, I have what I discovered with respect to is our current method of 5-year smoothing for an actual value of assets consistent with the GASB exposure drafts. It was only in GASB exposure draft 27 that I found any real reference to the actuarial value of assets, although they don't call it that. And the sole regulation there is that the smoothing method cannot exceed 5 years and that the period must be closed. So it can't be an open 5-year period. It has to be a closed 5-year period. So it's the most recent 5 years, and that's it. And so based on that, my conclusion is that we don't need to amend our actuarial value of assets in order to conform with GASB. The bulk of what I found is attached, these references to the 5-year period, and what they refer to, the reference that's used in the exposure drafts is changes in plan net opposition. And if you look on, for instance, if you look on page 9 of the memo, and it's also page 9 of the exposure draft, the boxed item towards the bottom of item B2, the last sentence, recognition in pension expense should be accomplished using a systematic and rational method over a closed 5-year period, beginning in the period in which the difference occurred. The regulation is 5 years. It's got to be closed. Ours is closed, and it's 5 years. So, members, that's my assessment of whether we conform with GASB with respect to the actuarial value of assets.
Questions? We'll
have
a test on this tomorrow morning.
Yes, still working on the mortality table.
You're okay.
Are these things? These are the things that Scott DeVille had totally read before.
Yeah,
he came in today. Out. Give him the test.
Yeah.
He didn't hear this. What? He didn't hear this.
Yeah.
Okay, I want us to walk through it. Let's give Mr. Martin a little bit of a breather here. We want to walk through the bills that are on our backlog.
Okay.
But at this point, I want to give anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on any item that we've talked about today or that someone who cannot be here tomorrow will give an opportunity. Yeah, Mr. Stanton, did you...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That's the State University Faculty Unions. And I'd like to just briefly comment on the Nebraska Cash Balance Plan and urge you to exercise caution going down that road. I don't think it's a very good idea. We're kind of unusual. We're one of the unions that are covered primarily by a defined contribution plan. Back in 1989, we requested such a plan because it's kind of the norm within higher education. And it has a lot to do with our kind of unique demographics. And most of our people, we get a choice between TRA and IRAP, the individual retirement account plan, when they get hired. And most of our people are in the defined contribution plan. Frankly, you know, as Senator Daley pointed out, the choice in Nebraska isn't between a defined benefit plan and the cash balance plan. It's between the defined contribution plan and the cash balance plan. So since our people are in the defined contribution plan, we're kind of concerned about that. I think we have a better system for people who to help them make good investment decisions, and that is we have target date funds where a person that doesn't like to make investment decisions has the option of going to a target date fund where they simply pick the date that they think they're going to retire, and then they're in a fund that is managed by a professional fund manager that makes investments that are appropriate for somebody that distance from retirement. And if the person is young, you know, if they choose a date that's far out, they'll be very rich in equities, which yield a much higher rate of return. And then as they get closer to retirement, they move them into more conservative portfolio, more like 50-50 between equities and so forth. And what that does is it yields a much better rate of return than the 5% or whatever that the cash balance plan in Nebraska yields. And having those better returns early in your career over a long career can make, you know, 30-35% difference in the amount of retirement income you have at retirement. So before you go down that road, I'd encourage you to look at the target date funds that we already have in the IRAP plan. Mr. Bergstrom mentioned that they've gone to those target date funds within the deferred compensation plan, and I think that's a much better route. Thanks.
Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chair, does the employer put money into the IRAP plans too?
Yes. Employer puts in 6% and the employee puts in 4.5%.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Others who would like to be heard? We've got you down for tomorrow, unless you want to do it today. Ms. Crockett?
I'll be here tomorrow.
Okay. Whatever. We'll be taking up, I think you were out when I announced that we'll be doing testimony first thing tomorrow morning, too. And we've got Mr. Stinson, who's going to be here. We need to take that. Mr. Brainerd is going to do a presentation of what's happening around the country. And Dr. Briggs is going to be here tomorrow from the American Enterprise Institute. We've got Jan Allswager from Education Minnesota, who apparently there's some of her members that want to speak as well. So it's up to you or anybody else if you wanted to take some time now or tomorrow. Pardon me? Yes, and we're going to have Mr. Bicker come forward as well to talk about some recent developments there. Ms. Crockett?
Mr. Chair, Kim Crockett, Minnesota Free Market Institute. Why don't I just grab, since it's 4 o'clock instead of 5, and tomorrow might get crowded, then I'm leaving as sure. much time as possible for tomorrow. And I just want to make a very brief point this afternoon. Going back to item 2 on the agenda, an assumed rate of return, and I'll try to have a study printed out that I actually got from Keith Brainerd this afternoon from NASRA. But just on trends for assumed rate of return and helping you make a decision, I don't think a move to 8 would be imprudent. And on the contrary, arguably it's still on the high side and still higher than where the nation is trending. And as I said, I'll get that study that he sent me today because I can't print it out from here. But right now, there's 126 identified public funds in the United States. 10 of those have an assumed rate of return right now of 8.5%. 8 out of the 10 are Minnesota pension funds, as I understand it. So we're still very much at the high side. There used to be 12, but we're down to 10 just in the last 6 months because, again, it's states are and other pension funds are trending away from that high end. Just in the last 6 months, we've changed from 59 funds at 8% assumed rate of return down to 56 funds. And then there are approximately 47 public pension funds that assume something less than 8% now, all the way down to 7. And there used to be only 38 under that number. So just in the last year, legislatively, the trend is moving very quickly. So, you know, to your discussion earlier, you know, would it be imprudent to make that move? At least nationally, the trend is not just down to 8, but below 8 assumed rate of return. And I'll get that study for you. I was trying to find a compilation of legislation that happened in the last year, and I think Mr. Brainerd will provide that for us. He may even bring it tomorrow. So that's all I have today.
Thank you. Anyone else who wishes to be heard? If not, we will have that opportunity again in the morning. And what I'd like to do now is have Mr. Martin walk through number 8, or 10, I should say, in your packet. There's a list of bills that are in our hopper, so to speak. And we're not going to go into any real details here, but Mr. Martin, I think it would be helpful in walking through this is to give us a sense as to whether this is if it's more of an individual bill solving a particular problem, or if it suggests some policy issues that we need to be aware of, significant policy or precedent. If there's a bill here that is setting a precedent, I think I would like to be able to kind of mark up this list and identifying those bills that are precedent-setting, significant policy issue, or sort of run-of-the-mill individual pension bill. So is that fair?
Sure. Yes, members. The first page of the October 21st memo gives you the 19 bills that are remaining from the 2011 session, and they're just organized by House file number, so they're not grouped there in any manner other than introductions, the date of the House introduction, presumably. Pages 2 through the end of the memo, 6, are an attempt to group these things substantively and to try and pick things that were more general and deal with them early, and to have the things that were more particular or specific appear in this list towards the end. Beyond that, there's no suggestion of relative importance, but just more their application. The first item, item A on the top of page 2, deals with interest rate actuarial assumptions because this applies to all plans, and it is something that's been on the Commission's radar for a period of time now. Is here first, and this is a comprehensive reduction in the current interest rate assumption by 1% for essentially all of our defined benefit plans. So that's A1. B has to do with pension fund investment authorizations. This is basically a bill that arose out of a mandate in the 2010 legislature, in the 2010 Omnibus Pension Bill, that the state auditor's shop put together a working group to review the authorized investments for the various pension plans, the State Board of Investment, First Class City Teacher plans, and the various local public safety plans. There are a few substantive changes, but nothing that is hugely significant. In a number of administrative changes, this was put together by representatives from the various types of plans and from the State Board of Investment and the State Auditor Shop. This is not unduly controversial, I wouldn't think. Item C has to do with contribution rate changes. This bill was heard but not acted upon by the Senate's Governmental Operations Committee. It would modify the member contribution rates, would increase the member contribution rates as drafted by 3%, and would reduce the employer contribution rates for all of our defined benefit plans by 3%. In the Senate, they did entertain an amendment which changed the offset or the up and down change from 3% to 2% if memory serves correct. But it is a increasing proportion of pension funding shift to employees away from employers. It did not attempt to recapture any state aid or any state funding based on the reduction in employer contributions. So where it reduces employer contributions, that would free up local or agency budgets. D has to do with PERA General and a membership change and a coverage change. Has to do with the Seaway Port Authority of Duluth, which under 1959 legislation was exempted from PERA and which currently has a defined contribution program. They're requesting that they have an opportunity to be included in PERA General and to purchase prior service credit for their past service in PERA General. E on the top of page 3, there are three bills under the general topic of PERA privatization law changes. Number one has to do with a couple of plans that are currently privatizing. There is a procedure in place for look at these privatizations and to ultimately add them to the privatization law. And Cedar View Care Center and Traverse Care Center have gone through that process. So this is not a particularly significant substantive change, with the exception that, if you remember, the October meeting, Ms. Vanek presented to you the overall problem with the privatization law, that it doesn't seem to work well anymore. It has certain problems because of changes in deferred annuities, augmentation rates, and that's the topic that's dealt with in number 2 under E. This is a reduction in the deferred annuities augmentation rates that are the major benefit of the privatization law, making them more consistent with the changes that were made in 2010 for PERA General in their deferred annuities augmentation rates. So this one may or may not solve the problem that Ms. Vanek has identified, is a reduction in the beneficial aspects of the privatization law for most or all future privatizations. And so this one is more significant from a policy standpoint. Number 3 is looks like it's a generally applicable bill, but I suspect it's really a response to a constituent request. And if I understand the factual circumstance right, would take a public employer that privatized prior to the privatization laws being first enacted and extend the privatization law to the employees of that particular health facility in Mabel. F is the legislation with the PERA statewide volunteer fire retirement plan. For newer members, Minnesota has had a long tradition of having local volunteer fire pension programs. After a long period of study and deliberation, a statewide volunteer fire plan was created in the late 2000s. It has a small number of fire departments that are currently members, and presumably more will be coming over time. As items of concern for that plan, that really set of plans develop, there is a task force that assembles the response, the legislative response to those problems, and in this case, this is their piece of legislation that's been forwarded by the PERA Board of Trustees from the Volunteer Fire Task Force. And it, what it basically does is permits some additional contributions by municipalities to their particular account, modeled or reflecting the general practice in local volunteer fire plans, where a municipality can make extra contributions to their particular volunteer fire plan to, in effect, pre-fund benefit improvements. And this would be permitted in the statewide plan. While it's a substantive change, it's not particularly controversial or particularly precedent-setting. G has to do with volunteer fire plans. There's just one bill here. There is a working group that the state auditor has convened every year for, I think, 4 or 5 years now, which takes a look at the volunteer fire laws for the local volunteer fire plans and suggests changes that are needed in those laws. There are some items here that are substantive, such as increasing the number of salaries that are payable from a volunteer fire plan beyond the current officers permitted to receive salaries, and modifying the return to work by former firefighters, those laws. While they're somewhat substantive, they're not particularly controversial, probably, and not particularly precedent-setting. H has to do with judges, and about the last half of the items in this bill relate to retirement of judges. This is apparently an attempt to try and have judges fill out their entire terms and not to and to reduce the number of judges who will be appointed by the governor rather than elected. It does reset the mandatory retirement age for judges. It does allow an early retirement by judges who hit that early age in a general election year, and imposes a reduction on the annuity of judges if they retire in a way that creates a judicial appointment by the governor. This is in the House and not in the Senate. There are presumably controversial items or substantive changes related to judges unrelated to pensions in the first four items, and there are some significant aspects to the four items E through H in the bill from a pension standpoint. The second bill is on the bottom of four, has to do with judges, and it changes the mandatory retirement age slightly for judges, and it's not substantive or particularly controversial from a retirement standpoint. I'm not sure from a judicial office holder standpoint how substantial it is. Judges are one of the few, if any, public employees in Minnesota that still have a mandatory retirement age, and it's age 70. I is an early retirement incentive. In 2010, there was an early retirement incentive enacted by the legislature, and this is essentially a recasting of that 2010 incentive. It's early retirement, but it's not a early retirement benefit from the pension funds. It's a paid health insurance for up to 24 months for someone who retires early. So the benefit is an insurance benefit, and the inducement is to retire early, presumably to help alleviate budgetary problems. J is miscellaneous. The first bill has to do with the post-retirement option program. We've tried to get more information on what the purpose of the bill is, and haven't had much luck, so I'm not sure that bill is actively in play. The second bill, House File 1626, revises the MSRS unclassified plan. It appears to be a correction or a clarification in the 2010 omnibus bill with respect to when someone in the unclassified plan can transfer to the MSRS general plan. In 2010, the option to transfer was constrained to some extent. I think this is simply a clarification of that, so not particularly substantive, not particularly controversial. K, the local bill, the Rukavina bill, has to do with the Virginia Fire Relief Association. This is probably unnecessary. Virginia is consolidating with PERA Police and Fire under the 1987 general consolidation law, even though it doesn't fit quite as neatly as it did in 1987. If there is anything coming out of this that may be needed, is the Virginia Fire amortization date, the date which it was supposed to be fully funded was 2010. They weren't fully funded in 2010, and there isn't a clear amortization date for them under current statute, and there may need to be one. L is the small group or single person bills. There's a person at Minsky who failed to elect TRA coverage rather than IRAP and wants a second opportunity. We attempted to resolve this problem last year with requiring greater counseling and clarifying some of the deadline dates for when a person could or could not choose defined benefit coverage rather than defined contribution coverage. This person predated all of that, so it's a cleanup potentially of that particular circumstance. Number two has to do with a Crookston Township road grader operator who was omitted from PERA coverage for something akin to 17 years and now is seeking to have pension coverage for the 17 years that he was omitted from pension coverage. Item three has to do, this is, number two is not an uncommon bill. The length of time is probably longer than normal. But a fair number historically of the special laws that we end up dealing with as part of the Pension Commission deliberations are individuals who have omitted or uncredited periods of service in local government. It's largely a function of the optional or the non-mandatory coverage for low-paid employees in PERA and a problem of correctly identifying when they cross over to the mandatory coverage requirements. Number three is a former Senate employee who wants to be covered by the 2010 early retirement incentive but didn't match it, didn't apply in a timely fashion for the incentive. And four is a TRA member with a period of voluntary layoff and a period of leave of absence for which the person didn't get service credit. This bill, I think, is a repeat of an earlier attempt to make the same change several years ago that was unsuccessful. So there's actually a precedent against doing that. The commission sometimes allows a second opportunity to argue a request like this, but not always. So, remember, that's as quick as I think I can do it, giving you a sense of what's
helpful
on our docket.
That's helpful. Any members aware of anything else that's likely to come before us? We can expect that there will be.
Members, I do have one of a number Senator Rosen, who's not here today, did tell me at the end of the October meeting that she will be pursuing a piece of legislation to consolidate the Fairmont Police Pension Plan into PERA Police and Fire. Fairmont would be the last of the local police and paid fire plans. One time there were approximately 50 of them, and Fairmont is the last.
Fair. Yeah, she may be aware of that, too.
Saw how much fun we had last year.
Yeah. I think the
Minneapolis scale, people owe her one.
I think the
one.
Scale here is a little different. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, maybe you should, or maybe it's known, you should send out a lot of new members. So you should send out a notice to all the members saying that if there are any pension issues, if there are any, you know, it's usually the individual. The ones that always get me, you know, worried is the ones where you have an individual item that we could, that isn't really controversial and doesn't set a bad precedent. And we just don't get to do it because they didn't get it in on time. So
that's a
trying
good,
to what
that's a
wasn't
good suggestion.
Representative, Senator Betzel was very fussy about not doing anything that we had looked at during the interim.
Okay. And I think that's a good suggestion, and Mr. Martin. Maybe you could help me draft what we want to tell members as to how they should proceed with that.
And tell them, you know, Mr. Chairman, I would have some kind of strong words about not wanting things that, you know, particularly for the second year of the session. The first year, it's not quite as obvious because there are so many, because there are new members.
Right.
Hopefully, there'll be a lot of new members next time, too. But the you know, for the second year, people have kind of been around, and they ought to be able to get their stuff in early.
Yeah, good point. We will we'll send out a note on that. Any other items, Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I would like to place dibs on number 13, 12, and 6. 13 and 12 are studies that were done, and then the recommendations that came from those studies or the working group kind of thing, and we haven't heard them yet, and I think we should and include them in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Well, I would invite the members, if you have a particular interest or concern in any bill, let me know so I have a heads up on that. So appreciate that. And
the other bills with my names on, I can't quite remember everything that was in it. So if the persons that brought them to me want to tell me about them.
Okay. Fair enough. Any other thoughts or suggestions on that? If not, tomorrow we will take testimony from, as I mentioned, Dr. Stinson on the salary scale assumptions, payroll growth assumptions. Mr. Bicker will be here to talk about the recent action of the SBI regarding Minnesota Bank investments. We will hear from Dr. Biggs from the American Enterprise Institute on a variety of pension issues. Jan Alschweiger from Education Minnesota and some teachers will be here talking about some of their issues or concerns. Kim Crockett, Mr. Brainerd will be here. Remember, we invited him to come and talk about what's happening in other states. So we will go through all of those and then spend the rest of the morning talking about where we want to go with the policy issues that we've been addressing. And to get a sense of the commission, to what extent are you interested in coming up with something relative to the earnings assumption with respect to hybrids, possible hybrids, and any other of the policy issues that we've been talking about, where you'd like to go. So that's the plan for tomorrow morning, and we'd appreciate it if you could be here on time, and if you have to go do something else, at least check in and we can get a quorum and get started. That would be helpful. And Senator Dibble, again, welcome. Glad to have you with us. And anything else for the good of today?
He's still smiling.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
First day.
He was in and out.
We stand adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Two bars.